Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. This past Friday, Deb Fleming, who is the founding executive producer of Australian Story on ABC Television, that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, is retiring after 19 years. This was a show that broke the mold for the ABC. It had a more gentle and confessional approach to the program and its interviews. She'd been at the helm for 19 years, as we just said. We now have this exclusive interview that was done with Richard Ady. He began by asking her how it all began.
I was commissioned by my then boss, Paul Williams, to start a new program which he thought could be a domestic version of Foreign Correspondent. And it was to go to air on, I think, a Saturday night, and it was to be an hour long, and it was to be magazine style. And then halfway through the planning process, the budget got halved, which necessitated a very considerable rethink, and it morphed into a half-hour program to go to air midweek. That turned out to be one of those really lucky things because it forced us in a much more radical direction than a local version of Foreign Correspondent. And we came up with what turned out to be Australian Story.
So you said we had to move in a much more radical direction. What was radical about it?
We always wanted the reporters to be somewhat in the background, largely in the background, and to have minimal narration. But we decided, based on early pilots, to strip the reporter narration out of the equation altogether so that the subjects become the narrators. And it forced us more strongly into the direction of difference. We had to have a real point of difference with the rest of the ABC News Division spectrum. So we went very firmly down the pathway of a confessional approach to interviews rather than adversarial. This was something that Caroline Jones pioneered on Radio National a long time ago with the Search for Meaning programs, which I'd always admired. We were looking for stories, again, just looking at the rest of the spectrum, we were looking for stories that were more positive, more affirming, sometimes inspirational, because we sensed that there was an audience demand for some of those qualities. Again, just looking at the broader spectrum and where we might complement it, where we might fill a gap.
It was a departure for you, wasn't it? Because you EP'd the programs that were adversarial.
Absolutely.
The 7:30 report, firstly in New South Wales and later in Queensland.
That's right. That was the model I grew up in. But this was the era of Frontline, which some people will remember, the satirical program, which parodied commercial current affairs. But look, there were uncomfortable truths, I think, for those of us doing TV current affairs in the ABC as well. And the way the audience responded to that and the sort of ugly recognition about aspects of the worst characteristics of the sort of nightly current affairs model made me think we should invert the model.
How long did it take to go from this is what we think we want to do to this is it?
It probably took 8 or 9 months, perhaps a little less, perhaps 7 or 8 months.
All right. I suppose I'm keen to drill down into the elements of what makes an Australian Story. How many main interviewees do you need for it to work?
It varies considerably. It really does vary quite a lot. There is generally a key point of view or a main interviewee, and around that you might have as few as 2 or 3 others or as many as a dozen.
Really?
Hmm. Well, sometimes, of course, we do two-parters. Mm. So we do 60 minutes in terms of duration. So I think the Kerry Packer two-parter that we did last year, I think we probably had a dozen interviewees.
So there's not a simple checklist. It's not just protagonist, spouse, friend, colleague.
It's those people who can shed light on the core individual. We are looking for insight rather than insult. If you're featuring someone controversial, that sets up some special challenges because you have to provide context for the added understanding that you're seeking to convey of this particular individual.
How many stories are on the go at once?
Each producer, it varies, but it's not unusual for each producer to have sort of two or three actively in mind. They're generally only shooting one at any given time, although sometimes they'll be juggling a couple. And we work on an average 8 or 9 week story cycle, which is actually a very short cycle for a documentary, as you'd be aware. I mean, a lot of people spend 1 or 2 or 3 years on a documentary. So to turn them around that quickly to produce 43 episodes a year with a relatively small team and really quite a small budget is quite a feat.
So how many different stories are you across on any given day? Or is it more a focus on the story in editing?
Well, as the story is about to go to air, the focus on it intensifies incredibly that last week or the last fortnight before it goes to air. It becomes very intense. But supervising producer Rebecca Latham and myself, we would actively be fretting about, you know, a dozen stories at any given time. They would be inhabiting our waking moments and sometimes our sleeping moments as well. There's always about that number that are very much in the forefront of your consciousness.
So we're seeing half an hour at the end, and I'm sure the duration's 29 or something like that.
It's supposed to be 28, but we're an undisciplined mob and we routinely burst the banks.
How much tape are you shooting to get that 28 or 29?
It varies quite a bit depending on the individual producer. We call it the shooting ratio, and it's often pretty time consuming. I can't give you a hard figure, but in order to get people really comfortable in front of the microphone, and you would know this, you need to spend time. You don't just roll up with your camera and hit the button and off you go, and people are going to divulge the secrets of their psyche. It can take time to just build trust, let people speak about the things they want to speak about and get down to what you hope will be a somewhat deeper level. But it can vary enormously. I mean, the recent episode that we did with Gina Reinhardt, we only had 90 minutes for that interview, which is very little by our standards. That would be at the very low end of what we would hope for. So we were dependent on supporting interviews from people around her who knew her well to help fill out the picture.
So many media think, okay, as soon as you get a tenement, all that happens then is money gushes from it. There is nothing that could be further from the truth. To develop Hope Downs, it was so intense. There wasn't a weekend off. There were endless 16-hour days. There was some occasional overnights at the office. But we did it.
She's unusual in that she's in the public eye. She doesn't talk to the media much. But she's very different to somebody who perhaps we haven't heard of before you bring them to national attention. And I'm wondering about those people in particular. How well do they understand what they're getting into?
We are really conscientious and ethical about trying to acquaint them with what will be involved. It's a bit of a roller coaster.
It's pretty grueling,
them.
I imagine.
It is quite grueling, but for most people, it is in the end satisfying. But there is nothing that you can adequately convey, really, that fully prepare them for the experience. There is something about it that for a lot of people is akin to entering a confessional booth or sitting on a psychologist's couch. People divulge more than they expect to, often. But, you know, we have a responsibility around that too. I mean, if our interviewee is someone who is absolutely inexperienced in the ways of the media, obviously, there are responsibilities around that would not apply if you were featuring Kevin Rudd or Julia Gillard or John Howard.
So does that mean that if somebody says something that you know as EP, and the producer who's there will know that that's gold, but maybe it doesn't show them in the best light, and it does illustrate how inexperienced they are, that the producer might say, are you sure you want to say that? Would you go that far?
It would very much depend on the circumstance. It is impossible. I mean, this is part of what makes it so complex and so difficult. We have to operate within ABC News editorial guidelines, and they confer quite serious ethical responsibilities as well as editorial responsibilities. So it is almost impossible to give you a hypothetical answer to that hypothetical situation that would apply in all circumstances. It's a really tricky one. But I guess the thing is, because it's not live, there is always an opportunity to reflect, to, you know, in the case of a producer, to talk to myself and the supervising producer and say, look, you know, Joe Blow has disclosed this.
It depends on the disclosure, of course.
It depends on the disclosure, but this could be very damaging to Joe Blow's life and to those around Joe Blow, but it's editorially very significant. What should we do? There's this real framework around the team, around the program team, that allows us to discuss and work through some of those editorial dilemmas when they arise. And they are all different. Almost every story throws up dilemmas of one kind or another. And it is incredibly common for the interviewees to get extremely worried in the lead up to broadcast.
How do you decide who you're going to go after?
We have a very clear remit, and it has shifted or evolved over the years, but we do have a commissioning checklist that's got about 25 criteria on it, and they are chosen against the remit of the program. So it's about whether it fits our remit or not.
But obviously, you just did Gina Rinehart.
We did.
But this week's program is the first part of a two-parter about the granddaughter of Sir Donald Bradman.
Well, it's broader than the granddaughter. It's about the whole family, really. But she's probably the central character, but around her you have her father, Donald Bradman's only son, and the other grandchildren. So it's an exploration of the family and almost the toxicity of fame, how his extraordinary worldwide fame impacted on them. And it's a fascinating psychological study. She's a trained psychologist.
Didn't John Bradman actually change his name to Bradson to stop having...
He did.
Yes,
at one point. He did. And then he changed it back.
Yeah, that's relatively recently, though.
Yeah, in his father's declining years, he did. His father was still alive when he changed it back.
All right, so that story, how long has that taken from go to woe?
We first started pursuing that story about 12 years ago. Little snippets would sometimes appear in print media about John Bradman. And then I think we became aware of Greta Bradman and her beautiful soprano voice and her ascendancy, if you like, as a soprano. And we just thought that family, Greta, that story was a very natural fit for Australian Story. But they are very wary of the media, of course. So it's been a very long process of communication and meetings in person and gradual persuasion. And also, very often, it's about the circumstances finally being right for people. They're finally ready. They think it's a good time. And all that work, from our point of view, comes to fruition.
So, actually, it's interesting because you said a good fit. And it makes me think about the story arc that you have. I know it's not always the same, but what are the elements that sort of have to be there? There's overcoming something, isn't there?
Not always, but what we work with is classic three-act structure of the kind that classically applies to any kind of storytelling in whatever genre, but I guess you particularly see it in the best dramas, in feature films and on TV and in plays. The stories have to go somewhere. There has to be some kind of climactic.
The voice you've just been hearing is that of Deb Fleming, the founding EP of Australian Story, who finishes at the end of the week after 19 years on air. So in all of that time, over all of those episodes, which is her favourite?
This sounds so unlikely in some ways, but the one that's going to air at any given time is generally a bit of a favourite. I'm sure the audience is really going to enjoy both parts of the Bradman story, first part of which has just aired, because I think it is a classic Australian story with a lot of depth and complexity and talking points. The Wayne Bennett story that we did 3 years into our history.
This is back in 1999.
This was back in 1999. Thank you for that date. Was a bit of a turning point for us because it brought together some of the evolving elements that we now see, well, hopefully almost every week. It represented a real maturation of the format and its potential because you had a well-known public figure, famous for being taciturn and difficult.
And very bearing successful.
His soul, and very successful, yeah. Bearing his soul. But it was all happening as well. He had a life of adversity. He had a personal life that reflected a lot of adversity. But it all happened at a time when the Broncos were going through a spectacularly bad losing streak. So that was the foreground, watching him close up. And he was very good about allowing that access in the dressing room and everywhere else as it was all going to hell on the playing field, at the same time as in the background, if you like, he was charting quite a difficult personal life. And he was doing it with great candor and emotion, which people just didn't expect from old Easter Island, Wayne Bennett.
Easter Island, it's a good way to call it. But yeah, if you're thinking back now and thinking, what was that? This was the thing in which we learned that Wayne Bennett, super successful rugby league coach, had children with disabilities, especially Justin, who we saw a lot of in the program. And we also saw the bond and the connection and the love between Wayne and his kids and the family.
And his wife.
Yeah.
His incredible wife, yeah.
Lots of times before you have success, you have failure. And I've had all that, you know, lots of failure. But, you know, Justin and Catherine and Elizabeth have all been able to give me that balance when I've gone home. I mean, Justin doesn't care whether we won or lost. He doesn't care about my dramas in life. You know, he needs his dad and he needs to play a game of cricket now and he needs me to be silly and he needs me to laugh and cuddle him. I haven't been able to come home and really brood and be sour and you know, lock myself away. And tried to. I think justice comes looking for me.
Let me ask you about a few more. Mm-hmm. John Howard, 2001 election. I think there was a Kim Beazley one as well.
They were a pigeon pair, yeah.
But the John Howard's the one that sort of stayed with me. Mm. And it's because we learned things about him we hadn't known before. Mm. It was genuine revelatory journalism, which you're not always doing, but you did on this one.
Yes. People in public life, particularly politicians, they do become absolute cardboard cutouts. Mm. And whatever you think of them, they're all human beings and they all have more to them than the one or two dimensions that mainstream media generally allows them. We obviously in our format invite people to draw their own conclusions, form their own judgments. But I think people are endlessly complex, endlessly interesting. And it's very satisfying when you can pull through more of those strands that add up to that human being.
Sometimes, though, it means that you've caught some criticism. So
yes.
Gina Rinehart, who we just saw recently, she's the richest person in the country. She inherited a huge amount of wealth. She's made more. But people are aware that she's been involved in court cases with her children, which is something I think that is probably beyond the ken of most of us. And the program presented a more rounded, more human, softer side. And that meant, of course, that the program got criticised for being too soft on this national figure?
Well, I think that's to be expected, and I think when you're in the media, you've got to accept that you're going to cop some criticism, and some of it may be fair and well-based, and some of it won't be. Some of it will be based on inaccuracy and inadequate understanding, and some of it will be something that we just have to accept as part of the price we pay for doing what we do. In terms of, sometimes you wonder whether people watch the same program, because some people were inspired by that program. And yes, some people were outraged by that program. Yeah. They were very offended by the notion that they weren't seeing a highly adversarial and critical piece. I mean, I would argue that in anybody's terms, that was a very significant interview with a very significant figure.
Yeah, and I wouldn't argue with that. I suppose the thing I'm wondering, and the thing that critics have said, is, but she would never go on 7:30 and subject herself to even just half an hour of full-on Lee Sales, because it would be adversarial.
It's a question for her, but I imagine that's correct, yes. Mm. But does that mean she should never appear anywhere?
No, I think we should get her when we can.
That's, I mean, it would be...
All right, let's talk about some others that are kind of more typical. And I know that some people you've gone back to again and again. There is Mac and Gail Shan. I've seen, I reckon, two or three of these where you've gone back again and again to this couple, and their story is extraordinary, isn't it?
They are a remarkable couple. They are Queensland graziers. Gail had her right arm torn off in an accident with a post hole digger. So she lost one arm and the other was kind of ripped so badly that it hangs loosely at her side, or at a, you know, she wears a sling on that side. So she has no arms. And a luminous individual, and her husband is a luminous individual as well, and he just takes such great care of her. They run the property together, they go to camp drafts, and they are a young couple who really early in their married life just had this incredible adversity to deal with, and they have just dealt with it, I guess, in a way that warms the cockles of everyone's heart.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I can remember in one program, he's doing her makeup.
I think it's difficult to go from being a person that some people might find attractive to being a person that you think no one could find attractive. Oh, Mac's amazing for such a bloke. It's very difficult to explain to someone where to put something without pointing. But maybe one semi-disaster, but other than that, pretty good, really.
Oh, it's a beautiful example of a wonderful way to open a story, because the way you open stories is really important. And in that simple scene of this farmer, and he looks like a farmer, he's got the hands of a farmer, and he is delicately applying very professional looking makeup to the beautiful features of his young wife. It embodies so much. It tells you so much in 30 seconds about their relationship, about what's happened to them, about the nature of their characters.
And it helps enormously that the camera loves both of them, doesn't it?
Of course it does. Of course it does. But the converse of that is that a story that we ran last year that generated a huge reaction was the story of a Brisbane man called Robert Hogue, who was born with a considerable facial deformity. And he refers to himself as ugly and almost celebrates it.
Which one are you proudest of? And it can't be the last one. I'm making that a rule.
It's impossible. I'm proud of so many of them. And to single out one is to deny so many others. You know, as part of the process of leaving the program and leaving the ABC, being asked to sort of go through lists of episodes over the years. And when I do, I'm amazed at, they're not all fabulous. You can't do fabulous every week, but I'm amazed at how many of them I remember with great fondness and affection. They're just, it's a very diverse palette. Mm. So they stand out in different ways. You're not going to wear it, I know, but I am proud of the Bradman one, partly because of the length of time it's taken us, partly, I suppose, because it's the very last program on my particular watch, partly because of the significance of Bradman in the Australian psyche, although not in its own way without little bits of controversy around the edges there, I suppose, and because at its heart, I guess it does have that psychological complexity. It has a touch of Shakespeare about it.
Deb Fleming from the ABC television programme Australian Story, who retired this past Friday. She was speaking with Richard Ady. It's now time to turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect and what's been happening. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith, IPS in Australia's global HF forecast. Normal propagation at low latitudes. Normal to fair at middle and high latitudes through August 8th. Space weather South Africa's magnetic conditions, active August 7th. Shortwave fade-outs unlikely. MUF unstable through August 8th. Met Office UK forecast through August 9th. Solar activity at low or very low levels with a 20% chance of R1 or R2 radio blackouts. A risk of geomagnetic activity reaching active or minor storm levels with a planetary KNX of 4 or 5, mainly on the 7th, due to onset of a coronal hole high-speed stream. The geomagnetic field forecast from Peter Kohlmann in Prague. Active to disturbed on August 7th and 8th. Quiet to active August 9th and 18th. Quiet to unsettled August 10th, 11th, 16th, and 19th to 22nd. Quiet on August 12th to 14th. Mostly quiet August 15th, 17th, and 23rd to 26th. From Natural Resources Canada, magnetic activity most unsettled August 7th to 9th in all zones. The outlook from SWPC in Boulder. Active geomagnetic field August 7th with ANK indices of 18 and 4, but 12 and 4 on August 17th, 20th, 26th, and 29th, reaching G1 minor storm levels August 28th, with ANK indices of 25 and 5. Lowest indices of 5 and 2 on August 9th to 16th. Solar flux dropping to 90 August 12th to 14th, rising to only 105 by August 25th to 27th. The annual Perseid meteor shower peaks around August 11th and 12th, but extends for a week or two before and after. Stand by for FMDX to burst in on open frequencies for a second or two. Bill Hepburn's VHF-UHF microwave DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting in extreme South Texas the morning of August 9th and all week off Baja California, the eastern and western Mediterranean through August 8th, all week around the Red Sea and Persian Gulf, August 8th to 11th, along the coast of Angola.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of the program. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.
Samba de preto velho, samba de preto.